Ebby was staying over at Calvary Mission in Manhattan. And what he said to me about finding sobriety and this Oxford Group program, which was unknown to me, it just made a deep impression on me. And so a little later on, I wound up going over to Calvary Mission and making a, something of a spectacle of myself. But I got the idea that this had to be the answer. And so I set off for Towns Hospital and checked myself in with Dr. Silkworth. He gave me a bed there. And it was during this time, Ebby came to see me. And one day I was very depressed, very despondent. And then I had this experience, which you read about in my personal story, where I felt that I was at the end of the road. And if there was a God, let him reveal himself now. And I had this illumination, this great experience, which I think was real. I've never had any doubt at all about that experience. I went through a lot of personal problems later on, depression, terrible, almost suicidal depression. But I never felt that that experience was anything but real. I've always believed in God, a higher power, life after death, and these things. And my doubts have been always been about myself as a going human concern, my personal faults and failings and this kind of thing, but never in what we came to call our higher power. So I stepped out of that hospital a free man. I was free from alcohol, and I had learned the idea that we should work with others, as Ebby had worked with me. While in the hospital, I had read The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James and learned something there. And we set out with the idea of helping other alcoholics in this movement called the Oxford Group. And we went to meetings at Calvary Church. And there was something exciting about these people. You could feel it in the air. They were all kinds of people. But they had something. There was no question about that. And I found some people there that I worked with. And I thought, when I told people my story, a man came up right away. And I thought that he was going to have the same kind of experience I had. And he was going to be sober from then on. And it was another 11 years before that fellow got sober. So in this process, the next few months, I learned a lot about working with alcoholics. I went back to Towns Hospital and was introduced to some people there. Dr. Silkworth let me talk to the patients, but none of them got sober. I was the only person that was staying sober during those months. And in the meantime, the family was starting to get restless about my not having a job. What is this fellow going to do? Spend the rest of his life going around talking to drunks and so on. And then the people in the Oxford Group, while they applauded my sobriety, why, they felt that I should be doing other things too. You know, there were other problems in the world that needed to be dealt with. So this was starting to develop in the Oxford Group very early on. Well, then I heard about a little machine tool company out in Akron that was the proxy fight that perhaps could be taken over in a proxy fight. And I fell in with a group on Wall Street that were willing to back me in going out there and soliciting proxies. The name of this company was the National Rubber Machinery Company, and it had been made up of four small companies in the rubber machinery business that had been merged in 1928, you know, at the height of the boom. And unfortunately, this machine tool company was no longer doing well. They had 113,000 shares of stock, and the stock was selling over the counter for about $1 a share. In other words, the whole company had a market value of $113,000. And in fact, you couldn't even buy shares on the market because most people were unwilling to sell their shares so cheaply. They just put them away in a drawer, so to speak, and were waiting until something happened. so you could hardly buy any shares on the market, which was an academic question because we had no money to buy shares anyhow. We were soliciting proxies in the hope of taking over the company, and I even got the idea that maybe I could become president of this company, and the job paid $14,000 a year, which was a tremendous salary in those days. The $14,000 a year, we could have lived very well and associated with the most prosperous people in Akron. So I went out there and checked in at the Mayflower Hotel, and I really thought we were going to succeed. There was a lot of dissension in this company. There were different factions, each representing one of the companies that had been merged into the company. And the merger hadn't produced any benefits of consolidation. Usually when you have a business merger, why, you consolidate some of the operations, and that way you get some benefits from it. But this hadn't happened. Each company was still running itself as part of this combined company, and each group was accusing the others of not doing the right thing. And it was a company that was ripe for restructuring and new management. And we really thought we could do that. And for a while, it looked like we were getting there. But when the shareholders finally voted in May, we lost. We were out. And we thought that there had been some hanky-panky in the way the votes were counted and all of that. And under Ohio law, any shareholder who feels that there's been fraud or anything in the counting of the votes, in the voting, can request a recount. So my partners left and left me in town there at the Mayflower Hotel for the weekend. They went back to New York on Friday. But I stayed there, and I was going to handle the legal matters and request a recount and get this matter straightened out in the hope that maybe there had been enough cheating that we still could take over the company. And that was the weekend that I was there, and I found myself on Saturday suddenly very unsettled, wondering what I was going to do the whole weekend. And there was a bar there, and I even felt like I might go into the bar and just sit there and have a soft drink at the Mayflower Hotel and just make some friends. And then I realized I was in real trouble, deep trouble. And that's when I decided I'd better get in touch with another alcoholic, because this is what had helped me in the 6 months. Nobody had gotten sober in that 6 months, but I had stayed sober myself. So I went over to the directory and looked. There was a list of ministers. And I called a Dr. Walter Tunks. And I don't know why I picked that name. It was just that unusual names appealed to me. And also, in Vermont, we used to call taking a walk was like taking a tunk or something like that. The name just came to me. But some years later, in 1952, Mel Barger went down to the Mayflower Hotel there, and that church directory was still there, and he figured that Tunk's name would have been at eye level to a man 6'3", which was my height. So maybe it was just the fact that the name was at eye level. Anyhow, I went back and I called Dr. Tunks. And he was very surprisingly cooperative. He was a member of the Oxford group, or associated with it. And he gave me 10 names of people to call. And none of those people could help me or knew of anybody I could contact. But one of them gave me the name, said he was going out of town, but suggested I call Henrietta Cyberly. And that was really the 11th name. It was one of these 10 names, gave me Henrietta Cyberly's name, and that hadn't been given to me by Dr. Tunks. And I was reluctant to call her, because years before, when I was flying high on Wall Street, I had met Frank Cyberling, who was the founder of Goodyear, and a very prominent man in Akron. And I just couldn't I thought Henrietta was probably his wife, and I just couldn't imagine myself calling up his wife and telling her I was a drunk from New York. But then something said I should, and I called her, and she was immediately receptive to the idea. She knew just the person. She wanted me to come out to her home right away, which was out on Portage Path in Akron. It was the gatehouse of the Cyberline estate. And there's that house right there. It's about a six-room, two-door house. It looks larger in that picture than it actually is. And the person living there today is Irene, who is a sister of, or a daughter of Frank Cyberline. She's more than 100 now, and I assume she's still living. And apparently part of the agreement when the estate was finally turned over to the city in 57 was that she lived there. And many of the AA members have stopped there and talked with her, and she walks around the grounds, or did up until a few years ago. But she was a sister of Frank Cyberline, who was Henrietta's father-in-law. And Frank himself had lost control of Goodyear back in 1921, and he had formed a company called Cyberline Company, which is under a different name today. And he was still a prominent figure in Akron, and he still lived in that 55-room mansion, but just in a small part of it. And he was quite a fellow. He lived to be 94 or 95 years old, and he believed in sleeping out in the cold. He would dress up, have a stocking cap and everything else, and sleep out on the porch in the cold weather. And but he felt that was helpful to do that. Well, he lived to be 94, 95, so who's going to argue with that? And Henrietta thought her father-in-law was a very fine man. She had nothing but high praise for him. Her husband, John Cyberline, was Frank's son. He was something else, and Henrietta talked by phone with Mel Barger some years later and told him that, well, John couldn't behave himself or couldn't grow up or something like, so I finally moved to the gatehouse, or she called it the little gardener's cottage, this gatehouse. I doubt that they even had a gardener then. I don't think the family finances were able to afford that by that time. And she let John live up in the big house. She called it the big house with his parents. And they were never divorced, but they were separated from then on. And then in 1943, she moved to New York and lived there till she died in 1979. And she was quite a person. But she was the one who had been in touch with Dr. Bob Smith and Ann. And the next day we were introduced in that gatehouse. Henrietta had us for dinner and put us off in a room, and we talked for 5 or 6 hours. And that's how we first met, and that led to the founding of AA. And I stayed in Akron all that summer. And I liked Akron. We even thought about eventually moving there. At first I lived for a week or two at the Portage Country Club, which is just down the street from the Cyberline Mansion on Portage Path. And incidentally, Portage means to carry. The message was first carried on Portage Path, let's say, the way of carrying. And this was a very fine country club. It had rooms and everything. And Henrietta had a friend named John Gammeter, who was a self-taught engineer, who was an inventor and had done very well. And Henrietta's daughter described John as a rough, tough man who cussed a lot. But she said he had also noticed the change in Henrietta that had come about. That's John's house there in Henrietta's neighborhood. And she had noticed the change that had come about as a result of her being in the Oxford group. So he had a lot of admiration and respect for Henrietta. So he used his membership in the Portage Country Club to let me stay there for a while. And I even was able to play golf there a little bit, at one of the finest country clubs in Akron. After a couple weeks of working with Dr. Bob, Ann suggested I come and live at their house, and so I stayed there all summer. And we started working with alcoholics, and one of our first successful cases was Bill Dodson, whose wife was also known, was also named Henrietta. And Bill Dodson, astonishingly, walked out of the hospital a free man and never drank again until his he finally died in 1954. And he was a very likable, folksy guy. He'd grown up in Kentucky and come to Akron and worked in a tire plant and gone to night law school to become an attorney. And a very devoted family man and a religious man, too. He belonged to a church, had even been a deacon in his church. And all he could not understand his drinking. All he knew that was when he drank, he went crazy, and he couldn't help himself. And he believed in God and everything else. And his wife, Henrietta, though, had a great deal of faith. And she became disenchanted with her own minister. And she went to another minister, and together they prayed about Bill's situation. And she later said that when she saw Bill and Dr. Bond there, she knew it was the answer. So that's the story. And I guess I'll take off my Bill Wilson hat now and return to George Trotter and Mel Barger. So. Swedenborgian churches in Manhattan, but I never heard anything about that, so I don't really know. But
Lois investigated and became very intrigued with the Swedenborg movement early on. I get the impression, here's a Swedenborgian with a true Christian religion by Swedenborg. That she investigated, found it interesting, did not pursue it to any degree. Bill had a brush with this through Lois, not his personal investigations. It's still alive and well. One of the fellows that likes to go out and collect books and give them to the collection here, just about 2 months ago, he's out there fooling around out in Arizona. He called me up and he said, "Not only did I find a whole collection of all these Swedenborg books, but I found a group of people who meet, I think, Tuesday night at this house, have group meetings, and still study Swedenborg today." And so that got me interested in trying to find a Bill Wilson connection. Where's your evidence? We got any facts? Where did Bill fit on this? You know, I have to date not been able to discover a direct connection between Bill and Swedenborg. But the Lois has mentioned that she was interested for a short time early on.
That was another thing, too. I read the book by Aldous Huxley, The Island, and they had these ravens all across the island. They were taught to say, "Here and now, here and now." And there was a lot of other things in there that smelled like he had had some acquaintance with Alcoholics Anonymous. And until, I think it was your book, wasn't it, that mentioned that Aldous Huxley and Bill Wilson were very good friends?
Well, that would have been in Pass It On, which is partly my book. But I knew about the thing with Aldous Huxley because when I wrote to Bill in 1956, I got a long letter back from him, and he mentioned, "A friend of mine, Aldous Huxley, has written," this is the way he put it in the letter. That was the first time I knew he had been a friend of Aldous Huxley. Apparently he met Huxley in the early 1940s when they were out in California. They met Gerald Hurd, and Hurd was a prominent guy out there, and it was apparently through this connection that he might have met Huxley. And he referred to Huxley's book, Heaven and Hell, about that time. It had come out recently. Do you have that book?
If we don't, we've at least got Brave, his most popular work, Brave New World.
Well, I haven't read Heaven and Hell, but I've read The Island, and it smelled an awful lot like he had some kind of contact with the AA.
Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World. We don't have Island or Heaven, and it's in the collection, but we didn't bring it. Often made very, very glowing commentary on Alcoholics Anonymous. He was quite thoroughly impressed with the spiritual investigation part of the thing. Later on, there you get into some weirditudes in the spooking sessions and trying to contact the dead and spiritual Then Bill was always interested in this all of his life, and he and Huxley had a connection there. The original, like Mel was saying there, that Gerald Hurd also investigated that. Gerald Hurd and Aldous Huxley were both from England. They got on the boat and came to the United States together, and then went to California. Hurd got very popular on a lot of his writings about spiritual matters and spiritualism. Investigated everything. He built a place out there called Tribuca. Say it, Mel. Help. Tribuca. It was a big complex, lots of buildings, and people all over the world who wanted to investigate spiritual matters, particularly meditation. Gerald Hurd was deluxe on meditation. But it got so popular after a while, Hurd said he became an administrator of a business kind of a thing, and so he just gave it to the Carishnas and got out of it himself, and that's when he and Huxley kind of disappear off the scene. Huxley and Hurd and Wilson came out, got involved, and that's his connection to it. When they were through New York, they'd stop in and visit Bill. There's several reports of their meeting. That's kind
of. Well, he doesn't mention AA in The Island, but he does. It's just that the philosophy and such smell like he had been around AA.
Yeah, they brushed shoulders. Yeah. Steve, question.
Yeah, I had. I heard that there was a guy named Roland who, with Dr. Bob's house or something, they were trying to contact spirits or something, and they had a. They did this on a regular basis, Dr. Bob had a bad experience and never tried doing it again, and that wasn't Roland Hazard, though.
No. That was the Roland. He was the medium that they went to. We're getting way down the road here into those speaking sessions. There, Bill always was intrigued by that. You know, one time he was out traveling. He was in at Cape Cod, and he had a man appear to him on the street dressed in some very old time clothes and stuff, and the guy started talking and he was kind of mumbling. Bill figured out through kind of listening that he was an ancient sea captain. He didn't know where he was. He was kind of lost and didn't know what was going on. And then some voices, no vision, just voices came in, and it became quite apparent that these were the members of the crew that the ship had sunk, and they were there to get their captain, and they convinced him to go on with them, and it was going to be all right. And Bill was shaking his head saying, what in the world is this going on? And boom, I'm not sure whether it was right away or the next day or whatever, he saw this monument there up in that area of the country. If you've ever been there, there's lots of monuments everywhere to sunken ships and an old bell or a statue or whatever. And he noticed the name of the ship, the name of the captain, some of the names of the crew, and he said, wow, what is it? From there on out, he was hooked. Spiritualists, mediums, palm reading, crystal balls, you name it, just in case, he was hooked. Possibility of return from the dead. Now remember, one of Bill Wilson's, if you want to call him heroes or whatever, he certainly called him a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, is William James.
Now, James had a brother, Henry James, quite a famous writer in his own right. The James brothers had an agreement, and when William James died, his brother, Henry James, came to live with William James's wife at the place of the death. The agreement was that he would stay there for 6 months, and these two people were the closest to James. If he was possible to, if any way to come back to contact, whatever, these two would be the probable hits. They were to stay there for 6 months just in case. And Henry James wrote a journal on that, and he said this was spooky and this was weird, but it was possible. And as soon as it was over, he was glad and out of there. The Spencer quote, the contempt prior to investigation. Bill Wilson would look and to check into anything he was investigating. It was possible. He didn't care that it wasn't probable. He was interested even if it was possible. These guys intrigued him. He intrigued them. And they went to these spooking sessions. They had three sets of regulars plus the Wilsons that would maybe have them at their house. They'd try Ouija boards, whatevers. A lot of this, we get into some possible opinions here. Lois was always very critical of others. She said, you're crazy, don't do it. Okay, I'll go with you. She was a non-believer. And then she said, one night, I actually made the table lift up off the ground and move off of there. From then on out, I was a believer. Nell Wing says she attended some of those sessions and she never saw anything, and she was concerned, and Bill would come out on the patio or the deck there and kind of talk with her and say, don't worry, just have a little faith and just keep on, it'll happen for you. And she said, I don't disbelieve it because it was all obviously going on. Everybody, I was the only one who couldn't see anything, but I have to be honest with you, I never saw anything, and Dr. Bob went on one of these out in Akron. They had some investigations out there and spiritualists and moved tables and stuff. And Dr. Bob looked at him and he said, honey, this ain't Christianity. I'm done with it right now. He saw something. They saw tables move or voices or whatever. We're not sure exactly. There's several stories about what they exactly saw. Conjured up spirits, But Bob became very convinced that this was very far removed from basic Christianity, and he wasn't interested. But Bill Wilson, the investigative creative, he looked into anything everywhere. Did that make him a believer? No. Did that make him a weirdo? No. Did that make him a very open-minded person? Yes.
I've heard that Bill believed in reincarnation. And I don't, although I did in a previous life.
I didn't believe in reincarnation the last time around either. Remember the time period we're in, too. See, Harry Houdini, the greatest escape artist of all times, he went out and he investigated all these mediums and spiritualists and horns coming through the air and voices and tables moving and all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And because he wanted to contact his mother. He believed it was possible. But when he went out, the greatest trick artist of all times, he discovered every single one of them. He knew exactly, and he could point them out, and every little trick, and he exposed them all. And so the era of the palm reading and the spiritualist and that and all of that sort of stuff ended. But that was because a professional exposed them. Remember, this was a time period when lots of people believed in it and did it. It is not unusual or out of line at all. Yeah, today, to put in his time frame, it would be hard unless you understood. Yeah, Tim.
Did Bill get the idea of the mind expansion through chemicals from Huxley? Because Huxley was real big into that before Bill ever got into it. Well, Huxley kind of turned Bill on to the idea.
Yeah, that's why I've always been cool to this. I've not been excited about Bill's relationship with Huxley. I don't think it was really all that healthy or good myself. This LSD thing, I think that was kind of one of the sad things in Bill's life, that he got involved in that. And I think if
if somebody had come to me and told about this thing, I would have said, don't do it. Because the very first time I ever read an article about LSD, my wife and I had just gotten married, so it must have been about 33 or 34 years ago. And I was already in AA and sober for a number of years. And I read about this miracle drug that was supposed to be doing great things for people. Poor old Cary Grant, for example, he had been impotent. Then he had taken LSD, and now he could perform again and everything like that. You know. Now, that was in the article. And stuff like that, see. Like, boy, this was the kingdom of God. No, it was in the article. It's not my opinion. But it was like the kingdom of God is going to come to us through this new drug. Well, we know it wasn't. It isn't that good. We know it's been a harmful, dangerous thing. But Bill's getting involved with it, I think, puts a little stain on his life about that period. For example, there was a magazine article by this... You remember there was a guy named Leary from Harvard? Timothy Leary. And so Leary was... He's still an advocate, apparently, of LSD and everything. And one of the things Leary points to is that Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, used LSD. See? And Bill, in his writings, like in a letter to Jung, a second letter to Jung, he said there was no harm in it, it wasn't addictive and all of that. And then I also talked to Humphrey Osmond. Bill was involved with two psychiatrists. A guy named Humphrey Osgood and another guy, a Dr. Hoffer. Hoffer was out in Canada, and when I talked with Osmond, he was on the medical school faculty at Alabama. And Osmond told me that LSD was safe, not addictive, and everything else. Well, I'm not going to argue with those guys, but I would never tell any AA member recommend taking LSD. I would never want anybody I thought a lot of taking it. I just think this stuff is no good, and I don't think we're ever going to find our answer in that. And I think it's a darn shame that Bill Wilson was involved with that. And the part about that in here is not anything that I wrote that's in passing on. Maybe they took a few of my writings on this, researched it. But I just was completely negative about this idea. It gave me a lot of problems when I worked on the passing on manuscript. It was a hard thing for me to deal with, that Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, had done this.
I have a question about Pass It On. Why didn't you finish it? Or why weren't you the only author of it? I know that you did extensive work on it.
Well, I did two manuscripts. And I started in 80 and finished in 81. And then they kind of took it over in New York. And I expected to work on it some more. There had already been a previous writer, Niles Peebles, whom I knew, and he had done the Dr. Bob book, and he had started on the Bill Wilson book. But Niles, just before he died, was having mixed feelings about this, and he told some people that he didn't think he could continue the book, and I don't know why exactly, but maybe he had these same doubts about this. And I had to wrestle with those things when I was working on these manuscripts. And they weren't satisfied with the second manuscript that I had completed, and I expected to work with them on the rewrites, but instead they turned it over to another writer, and I was pretty much out of it.
Sir, a couple of announcements need to make before we get out of here and get a break fitting into your last session here. And we only got, like, what, 2 minutes. Let's go ahead and take a few questions, and then we'll... Because I love the question-and-answer period. I got to know what you guys want to know.
My question... was you didn't mention this, and you know, you gave a really good life story of Bill, but what you touch on in your book I found very interesting was his electronic acumen, the way he used to build radios and sell them, and you know, that kind of led to his acumen, you know, studying something and finding out all about it and, well, putting it to use.
That's right. Now Bill, he had a great ability to go in and see the situation with anything, whatever it was. Like in a factory, I'm confident that Bill could have walked into any kind of a factory and quickly grasped how the production was flowing and what they were doing there and what the purpose of all these machines. Some people will go into a factory and it's they're lost. They can't understand it at all. I've even worked with reporters that weren't able to do that. But Bill, he could go in there and right away he knew what was going on. And he had a capacity for inductive reasoning. He could see a few things, and then he could see what the general principle was that tied all these things together. You didn't have to drop a house on him for him to understand these things. And he did have this mechanical, scientific, electrical side, even though he never worked in it, that enabled him to understand principles and things like that. I think he also benefited from his law school training, and that helped him when he wrote up all of these steps and traditions and everything. He was really kind of like a lawyer when he wrote the 12 steps, writing something so nobody could wiggle out, is the way he put it, like a lawyer composing a document.
Thank God he lost the proxy fight over the National Machinery River Drill, because you know, he'd gone on to have been a good president. It would have been success. That company was ripe. Today we would call it a takeover. He'd be the first, the guy that trumped Trump before there was a Trump, you know. And he would have been very successful, and there might not have been an AA.
Bill would have loved being working with takeover. God, he would have loved that, going over out and finding some troubled company and figuring out how you reorganize it. I mean, that would have just turned him on like nothing. He was made for that sort of thing. But those talents, they were put to use in AA, and of course you'll find that in my tape, My Search for Bill Wilson.
back to the Thomas Edison exams. One of the reasons Edison made up his own exams to hire a laboratory assistant in was Edison was interested in this inductive type of reasoning. He didn't care whether you knew the fact of how far the sun was from the moon or what's the atomic weight of cubonium or all of that. Does it work? How are you going to get it to fit? You know, the guy, the story Mel told about the guy that brought a piece of metal, and he was scared to death to plane down this piece of metal. It was platinum. That is very expensive stuff. And Edison didn't care. Plane it down. It's got to be this size. We got to make it work. That was the kind of mind Bill Wilson had, and that's why Bill won the exam to get to be able to work with Edison. They're a beautiful way of thinking, and then you can see this come out when he writes the big book. He don't leave no wiggle room at all, honey.
Why don't we take Don's questions?
One question. When the Akron group, when AA pulled out of the Akron group in Akron, didn't that disappoint Henry? Henry had a fiber name.
Oh, sure.
And she sort of had a falling out.
I think so, yeah. I'm sure she was. Henrietta attended the meetings and I think was kind of an authoritarian figure around there. And kind of got squeezed out a little bit because she wasn't an alcoholic. And there was, you know, some resentment in all of this. So this was a problem.
How about one? We got over in the corner.
I don't know if there's time for this now.
Sure.
But, and this might be a personal opinion. I'm asking you, Mel, because you know so much about Bill. But Lois had a miscarriage, and I know how that affected her. Did it have any big effect on Bill, number one, first part of my question? And number two, I've often thought that she was maybe mothered Bill so much because she didn't have any children, and maybe had she had children, Bill wouldn't have been quite as, she wouldn't have put up with quite as much.
That's a very
life question.
That's a good possibility. I think that's a good observation. Now, when Lois had this miscarriage, they tried to adopt.
Did.
Yeah.
When was that?
Well, probably in the 20s.
Is that before Bill's drinking got?
Well, no. In fact, one of their close friends told the investigators for the adoption agency what it was, that Bill had a drinking problem, and that's why they weren't able to adopt. And Lois had a lot of resentment about this toward the friend that did this. And, she was very clear on this with me. And then about, if they had had children, yes, if they had adopted, say, and had had a small child to care for, then Lois was the type of person, she would have put the child's welfare first, And maybe poor old Bill would have been out in the cold, you know. Maybe she wouldn't have supported him all those years because she would have been taking care of the child. Because I just have every reason to believe that Lois would have been a first-class mother in taking care of her child.
There's a Bill Wilson statement where he says, I married my mother.
Yeah. He recognized that in the relationship, and I think it was there. So we all set in.
We've got the Wednesday night meetings going at the Williams home in order to get Dr. Bob sober. And son of a gun, with about a month or so, Bill shows up and their prayers are answered. And Bill and Dr. Bob are together. They're not drinking. Ann is the one responsible, Dr. Bob's wife. She's the one that said, get Bill Wilson to get him over here right now. If you got an answer, let's move in right here, and we will spend the rest of the summer, and you guys do whatever you have to do. Where do we need the regular meeting at Williams's?
That's on Wednesday night, and that really was the start of AA, even though it was just part of the Oxford group at that time. And that eventually became what is called the King School Group. They met at the Williams residence from 1935 right on until late 1939. And, of course, Bill Wilson in New York separated from the Oxford Group in 1937. But they stayed on at the Williamses in Akron because the Williamses were great people. They didn't want to hurt their feelings. And there seemed to be some rapport with them, even though the Williamses were not alcoholics. And this just carried on until late 1939. And then for a short time, they moved to Dr. Bob's house after they left the Williamses. Now, if you've ever been in Dr. Bob's house, it's very small. But there's a letter to Bill from Dr. Bob saying that we finally broke the shackles, got rid of the shackles of the Oxford group, which shows that they were feeling some pressure or something there that they didn't want anymore. And he said they had over 70 people, maybe 75, in his house for the meeting the night before. Well, I don't know how they would get 75 people in his house. They must have had them standing on the commode and everything, you know. But somehow they did that. And then later they moved to King's School. And they met there for years. And that's considered the oldest AA group in the world at King's School. It still meets under that name, but in a different location, not at the King's School anymore. And incidentally, I just have to put in a personal plug. In that book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, I have two photographs in that book, the one of King's School and the one of St. Thomas Hospital. Yeah, that was my photograph.
Actually, that's a misnomer. When you see the front of it, because that's not the entrance that the AAs saw. The other one here is the back door. They went in through the fire steps up there. The first windows over to the right of that entrance by the chimney there is where they actually met. You got there, the meeting was at 8 o'clock. There was pretty much a sign seating, and everybody had a place where they would go sit, and you didn't take Dr. Bob's seat, was way in the back over there by the window ledge. We're talking about moving, actually stopping their meetings at the Williams house, but the Williams continued on having regular Oxford group meetings all the way up until 1945 still. They went to Dr. Bob's house there. It was the last Wednesday of 1939 there. They had there might have been three meetings there at Dr. Bob's house. Those were kind of preliminary planning meetings, a stationary place to stay, because there were two people in that bunch. Dr. Bob, I don't know here. They knew the superintendent of schools, and I think there was somebody in that group that knew the principal over at King's School or was dating his daughter or something like that. They were working. They knew they were heading towards King's School. Dr. Bob's place was just a little bus stop here. King's School is all in the same area. I went around
I've got a project I do every Founders Day. I got something to get done there. Last Founders Day, Sue gave me, when she was in high school, taking a typing class. She said she really loved the typing class. One of the classes she did quite well in it. She was very enthusiastic about it. She was trying to type everything she could get her hands on, you know. And her dad, Dr. Bob, come home one night and he said, need a little practice? She said, yeah, I'm looking like for alphabetizing things and getting them nice and neat. And he pulled out his AA address book, slammed it down on the table, and said, alphabetize and type that up. She did. She got an A on it. She was real happy and pleased with that. She kept it. Here's a list, not only of the members, but addresses, and in a few cases, those that had them, telephone numbers. So my project at Founders Day, of course, last year, I've been waiting to get this one done. Got the old camera out and went around to all these addresses. Got pictures of them all, see, the ones that still exist. Now, in some cases, it was an empty parking lot. I got a picture of that. In some cases, it was a gas station today. I got a picture of that. Whatever that address was. Yeah. And so, I typed it up, gave it back to her, and now it's all real cleaned up and good luck. Those are all, if you take a map of Akron and start putting pins where they're all of these, but they're all in a central little, you don't have to go very far. They all knew each other. King's School is just down the street. Dr. Bob could walk to it if it wasn't a bad day, you know. It was all right in the same general area there. So, anyway, they knew they were going to King's School, and so by very early in January of 1940, they had their meetings there. There weren't any chairmen, or some areas we call them monitors today. There wasn't anybody that was charge of the meeting or anything. The group elected a secretary. The secretary was everything. He was in charge of getting the spin in that area, and they still call him lead today. You gave your lead. He was also the treasurer. He also paid the rent. He also took care of all the costs. He was the one person did it all, and it wasn't a rotating position either. Then they would have a lead. What really happened was that the lead for that night would just simply get up, stand up front of the group, introduce himself, say a prayer, sometimes of his own choosing, sometimes out of the Bible, give a short lead or a speech on a very specific topic. The topics were like out of Emmett Fox's book, The Sermon on the Mount. A very common topic for the night would be the Bible, something very specific out of the Bible. Another common topic for the night might be the Upper Room. The Methodist Church put out and still does. As a matter of fact, the Upper Room, the monthly periodical by my grandmother used to keep those over in a radiator all the time, you know. It was first published at the same time that this group meeting got started here. Ernie Galbraith, he's later going to marry Sue, the guy Dr. Bob did. His mother, Mommy, came down with the Upper Rooms, put a little bucket out there, had a nickel on it, and sold them. She was the literature chairman. She wanted Ernie sober, and she'd go to any lengths to get it done. And they said there weren't ever very many nickels in the bucket, but the Upper Rooms were always gone. And you would go around to your other fellow members in those very, very early days, and you'd visit with them. You were kind of on a check-em-up committee, and you'd look around. And if you didn't see the Upper Room in their bathroom, opened up to the day's readings, you highly suspicion they might be in trouble. They go around and check on each other. Then after that lead, that short lead, 5 or 10 minutes, then the members would go around and make comments about the lead, and it kind of turned into a little open discussion, what we call today. Then they'd have a collection for the rent and for the coffee. Then they'd have what they call the secretary's break. They'd thank the speaker, they'd make their announcements, do any business if they had to. And then it was pretty common. Usually, they would have Dr. Bob come forward and close the meeting. And with his short, sweet, to the point, biblical influence, make a very powerful pull it all together. My home group, if you haven't known, I love my home group. I'm not just saying it's the best home group in the world. There's a reason why I say that. It's because it's the best home group in the world. And Gene over here, we have set aside at the end of our meeting to continue this custom, what we call Old Timers Minute. And we read a little thing. It says that we set aside at the end of our meeting an Old Timers Minute to share the wisdom and experience that can only come. We need to hear the personal histories of the experience of AA as they lived them. They prove to us that not only can it happen, but it can be for a long time. And then Gene has this phenomenal ability to take everything we've talked about, and we go for an hour and a half, everything we've talked about in that meeting, that big book discussion that night, and that he ties it all up. His experience and wisdom brings it home. It's very special to us. That's followed. What we did was to follow the custom of that early meeting. There was no humor. This was a life and death matter. Today we have a lot of fun, a lot of foxhole jokes and not so in those days. They didn't know this was going to work for a long time. They were still on the edge of maybe here. There was no applause. You didn't. There were no drunkalogs. You didn't get up there and tell you. There was only one person in that room that knew your whole story. There wasn't any dumping on the table and all of this. Or only one person in that room knew your story. That was your sponsor. And, of course, Dr. Bob. He knew everybody. He knew the whole story of everybody. And, of course, if Dr. Bob was your sponsor, then there was only one in the room, and a lot of course, had Dr. Bob's. Regular seats, Dr. Bob had told you to sit way back over in the table, over in a corner by the window ledge. And the reason for that was, when they made coffee back in those days, they believed in hot, H-O-T. They weren't afraid of being sued by somebody because they spilled a little hot coffee on them, you know.
Yeah.
They believed those drunks, not only was it heavy, thick coffee, but it was as hot as you could make it, almost boiling. Dr. Bob would go over. His custom was to get 5 cups of coffee and set them on the window ledge to cool off. So this wasn't a sharing, could I buy you, get you a cup of coffee, these were for Dr. Bob's and you didn't touch them. And he set them up in a row on the ledge over there. Then after the meeting, they had to get out of there very quick after the end of the meeting because the janitor, he didn't want to come in and work on Wednesday nights. He said, if you guys get out of here and you don't cause me any trouble, I'll allow you to meet here. Say, I got the say over whether I'm going to clean up after you guys or not. So they treated that janitor like gold. Then they go out to Kessler's Donut Shop, which is downtown there in Akron. Dr. Bob had come along and whoever wanted to. They were going out for coffee after the meetings, long time before you and I ever started that custom. And Dr. Bob would sit over and he would hold court. He'd tell his funny stories and keep them, but he would also, he was very serious. He wanted to keep that conversation. If you want to take him over to the side and unload on him a little, that was fine too. Kessler's Donut Shop isn't there anymore. Bill Wilson started this custom too in New York after the Oxford group meetings. They caught on real quick. Gee, let's just us go out. I got something special. Let's go buy you a cup of coffee. More AA was started, formulated, the foundations out there in Kessler's Donut Shop and Stewart's Cafeteria in New York, which is where they went. The heart and guts of this thing started over cups of coffee by the gallon. And I felt so sorry for this poor fellow who's managing this hotel here. When he first came in, when we were early setting up in here, Friday, and he came in here and he was going to fix up the coffee and this and that and the other, and he said, we'll keep the coffee coming. And I said, have you ever done an AA function before? And he said, no. And I said, let me warn you something. That ain't going to be enough, and you better keep it pumped. You better watch your kitchen, folks, because you don't really know how much coffee we're going to consume. And he said he overplanned by 2, and he discovered that wasn't enough. He's learned a lesson. Hey, he started over a cup of coffee, and it's still going on over a cup of coffee. What'd you have there, Peter?
I wondered if Bob ever just be an audience member at meetings, or was he always involved in
meetings? Yeah, every now and then he would participate, but he knew he was generally... Gene does the same thing in our meetings. If there's something really he wants to say, why, he pops right in. But it's pretty rare until he knows for sure he needs to get us on track. And the chair, by the way, in the back of the room, and very neat. This is a gut-wrencher. The chair that old Dr. Bob always sat back there with his cups of coffee on the ledge, when he died, nobody dared sit in that chair. But time went on, and one night, eventually, a newcomer who didn't know that that was Dr. Bob's chair came in and sat in the chair, and nobody said a word. It was as natural as rain. The guard didn't change in Akron until that newcomer sat in Dr. Bob's seat. That's the King School group, very powerful. And they still have, if you go to the King School, it's not in King School anyway, it's in a church now these days, but they still call it the King School group, still Wednesday night. They got Dr. Bob's Bible there at the, it's, you know, it's a plastic case there, and it's open to his favorite reading, Corinthians, unconditional love reading.
Don had something there.
I just want to say, I know you go to the Founders Day every year.
Yes, I try and get there every year.
The Founders Day, I went down about 15 years ago, and it's real nice. I mean, the people in AA in Akron, you stay at the Akron University. The kids are out of school then. They rent it that way. And that tower that they go up in, it was 10 floors up, observation tower, and that's where all the AAs gather, and they have the Alcatrons and everything. And then the next day, you know, that evening they would have a van available for you, take you to the clubhouses. And I think the one club was the Aaron Club, you know, where they have the absolutes still on the wall, honesty, unselfishness, loving, and purity. And then the next day, you know, we went on a tour with a bus. I did see the Mayflower Hotel just drive by it, because when I was there, it was a retirement home. And Dr. Bob's office up there in that bank building that you mentioned, and the St. Thomas Hospital they drive by, and then the donut, where the donut shop was in the King School. Of course, you're observing this from above. And then his Ardmore Street home. When I went there, people were living in it. Now I understand that somebody's taken it over.
Well, it's a museum.
Yeah.
It's an AA shrine now.
Maybe I'll tell you a little bit about some of those fellas in that, as some of the really, really early ones. Bill Dotson here. The big book. His story is Alcoholic Anonymous, number 3. Peter.
I don't know. Maybe I missed it when I was out of the room. But did you mention that the Sermon on the Mount was the book that they used at the meetings there?
No, yes. We mentioned that when you were out of the room.
Okay.
I'd like to tell a little bit about Bill Dotson.
Yeah, let's the very. There really was another one. Actually, we think there were like two or three. I've got a possible fourth that, as Dr. Bob would say, didn't ever gel. But Bill Dotson gets AA number 3 designation because he got and stayed. See, maybe we can get it. I'll tell you about a couple. One of them was a real fruitcake. Oh, we're on the tape. Erase that. Okay. We'll have to be a little politer.
I was interested in this list of early members. I hadn't seen this. This is the first 220 people in AA. And I got into AA in October of 1948 out in Ventura, California. A guy picked me up. I was 23 years old, a month after my 23rd birthday. And they had a little ad in the paper, and I wrote them a letter. And I was living in a rooming house. And this guy picked me up, and he took me over to a house. And the guy who picked me up had lived there in Ventura right along. And the people whose house he took me to, their names were Scott, Carl and Nellie Scott. And Nellie was probably a better, she was what we would call an Al-Anon now. They didn't have Al-Anon in 1948. But was she a wonderful Al-Anon? And she loaned me the big book. Just let me take the big book home. And of course, wouldn't George love to have that big book now, you know? It was one of the first printings. But anyway, while I was talking to them, See, Carl, Nellie was not a member, but she was really very enthusiastic, and they'd come out there from Akron. They'd lived in Akron up until a year or two before that. And while I was talking to them, a fellow came over who was their son-in-law, and his name was Eddie McCann. Now, these people are all gone now. I use their names. But Eddie was one of the first 200 members of AA. And he'd come from Akron, too. And he was married to their daughter. So he was their son-in-law. But he was one of the first 200 members. So I'm looking in this list, and I see number 136, Edwin McCann at the Conger Hotel in Akron. So this list was prepared before they moved out to Akron. But anyway, they took me to meetings for about 30 days. And I really had a good start in AA as a result of these Akron people. The meetings there in Ventura and around there were four meetings a week. One in Ventura, one in Santa Barbara, one in Oxnard, and one in Santa Paula. Now there are probably hundreds in that area. And Ventura then was about 10,000 population. And my wife and I went through there a couple of years ago. Dick Burns invited us out to a thing in Marin County. And so we rented a car and we drove up through there. And Ventura is now about 80,000. And the part that I remember is called Old Town. I thought it would be exactly the way I remembered it, but it's called Old Town. And the church where the AA meeting was is gone. But anyway, with Carl and Nellie, I heard a lot of stories about the early AAs in Akron, and I heard about Bill Dotson, and they referred to him as the guinea pig. And that name stuck in my mind, that this AA number 3 was the guinea pig. Well, then time went on. I went back to drinking, and I had a 13-month stretch of drinking and finally wound up back in Nebraska and got an AA. I moved out to Pontiac, Michigan, after I'd been sober a few months later. And they had a Thanksgiving Eve thing in Pontiac that was very good. And I was working with the guy who was chairman, was kind of took me under his wing. And in 1951, we had Bill Dotson come there to be the speaker. That was on Thanksgiving Eve in 1951. And when he arrived, I was surprised to find that they came on the bus from Akron, he and his wife, Henrietta. And Henrietta was a wonderful woman, Bill's wife. And her name, before they were married, by the way, was Dotson. And they were real distant relatives down in Kentucky some way. But just wonderful people. And I learned then that he didn't drive. Wherever he went somewhere, somebody either drove him or took him on the bus. Well, then he was our speaker that night. Well, the next year I was living in Jackson. And one weekend in November, I went down to Akron. I wanted to see what Akron was like. I'd never been there before. And I spent a Saturday with Bill Dotson. And we drove all over Akron in my car. He took me out to Derby Downs, because I'd always heard about the Soapbox Derby. You don't read about that much anymore, but at one time that was very famous. Showed me where they have the Soapbox Derby race. And he took me up to St. Thomas Hospital. And we were there, and the nun in charge of that ward that Sister Ignatia had started, her name was Sister Merced. And they had, in the meantime, transferred Sister Ignatia to Cleveland. So, Bill, I noticed a little bit of criticism of Bill Wilson on Bill Dotson's part. Not a great deal, but just a little bit. As we were walking out of the ward there at St. Thomas, there was Bill Wilson's picture and Lois's picture on the wall, both Bill and Lois. And as we walked by, Bill Dotson says, "You're not supposed to have people's pictures up like that. This is an anonymous program," or something like that. But it was a little bit of criticism of having Bill's picture there. And then Bill also told me that Bill Wilson had been out to Akron, and I suspect it was something like Founders Day, and that was before I'd gone. I didn't go to my first Founders Day until 1955, but this was probably the Founders Day that he'd come out to. And they had previously had a former radio announcer named Norman Brokenshire, I don't know if anybody ever heard of him or not.
Yeah.
But he broke his anonymity a lot, everything. But he was one of the early AAs, and they'd had him out there as a speaker. And a big crowd had turned out for Norman Brokenshire. Well, then, according to Bill, very few AAs turned out for Bill Wilson. That somehow there was some antagonism towards him or something. Now, this was in 1952, he told me that. And, but it was, what he implied was that a lot of the Akron people were mad at Bill for some reason or another. And I kind of stored that away in the old computer, you know. And then I asked him about that term, the guinea pig, that I'd heard from the Scots out in California a couple years before that. And boy, I could tell right away he didn't like that term. And guess who had coined the term? Bill Wilson. He said that they were at some big meeting, and they were all up on the platform, and while Bill Wilson was talking, he was referring to Bill Dawson, and he suddenly turned around and pointed at him, and he said, the guinea pig. And Bill Dawson never liked that. Well, I don't know, would you like being called a guinea pig? I guess not, but he was a folksy, friendly guy, just a warm guy that you know, everybody loved.
But his story did not appear in the first edition of the big book.
Now, let me tell you about that. But I think he was even against doing the book. And I think he told me, I seem to recall that he didn't think they needed a book or something like that. But anyway, his story wasn't in there. And for other people say that he wanted to be paid or something, but I don't know about that. But he wasn't the sort of guy to sit down and write his story, even though he was a lawyer. Who should have been able to do that kind of thing, but he wasn't the sort of guy to do that. But he obviously didn't like being called the guinea pig. And some years later, I asked Bill Wilson if he thought, and this was long after Bill Dawson was gone, if he thought that Bill might have been one of the guys in Akron that was against him. And Bill Wilson just simply said, well, Bill was ambivalent, meaning that he was for him and against him on different things. But Bill Wilson had said that when they went out to Akron with the idea for the big book, see, Bill came out there with the idea they do this book in 1938, and they just barely voted to do it.
That's right.
And it was only Dr. Bob's influence that pushed it through, because they said, what do we need a book for? We're doing okay. And they had 40 members, you see. Bill Wilson wanted the book so that he could get AA out to other places. I love those people in Akron, and I'm grateful for the work they did. But if it had been left up to most of those people, AA would be getting out of Summit County about now, I think. They had no vision, no imagination, none of the things that Bill Wilson had. Now, Dr. Bob had it.
But without some of the restraint that was put on there by the boys in Akron, Bill Wilson would have sold franchises all over the world.
Well, you know, something like that.
Somewhere in the middle, you know.
That's the requirement. But anyway, Bill Dawson, I saw him then in 52, and then in 53, he came up to Onsted, Michigan, and was a speaker there again, and I went to hear him. Onsted is a little town not too far from Jackson. And then I think that must have been the last time I saw him. He died. He was already suffering from a heart ailment. In fact, the day we were driving around, I had to take him home, and he had to go to bed about 3 o'clock. He needed a nap every day. And Henrietta, his wife, was there just getting ready to go to work. And I didn't know then that she worked, I guess. But she was a matron at the Akron City Jail. And years later, when I took those pictures in 1958, Bill Wilson out at the ceremony at Dr. Bob's grave, one of them has been floating around here. And I was in Akron a couple weeks later to do something at the Goodrich Company. So I called up Henrietta, and I went out to the workhouse in the afternoon where she was working in her office, and I talked to her for quite a while and gave her those pictures. And she's a very lovely lady and very easy to talk to and a very kind person. And I'm sure that, you know, you think of a police matron as being the beefy, butch type of person, but she wasn't that way at all, and I think she was probably a very kind person in her dealings with the female inmates there at the Akron City Jail. Then I heard later that she had passed on. And I just assumed she had gone. I'd seen her a couple times at Founders Day, I think. My wife and I saw her. From 1961 to 1978, I never went to a Founders Day because our family was growing up and there always seemed to be something going on. But I think we saw her in 1961, and then later I'd heard that she'd passed on. Well, then, to my amazement, I was there in 1980, and Dr. Bob's book had just come out, Dr. Bob in the Good Old Times. And I was talking to somebody, and somehow Henrietta's name came up, and they said, well, she's living out in Firestone Park with her son. And I thought she had passed on. So I called her up, and I went out there, and I got an extra copy of this book. She hadn't seen it. Well, she couldn't see it anymore. She was blind. And so I read the parts of it and referred to Bill and Dotson and them, and then left it with her. And then I think she did pass on it. She was in her 80s.
That'll teach her not to take a book from you again.
Well, but she was just a wonderful person and an example of some of the kind. Is that Henrietta there?
We have a letter here from written by Henrietta Dotson. She was requested. I believe it was Lois that requested she write down some early recollections and stuff. It's undated. Mel had mentioned, you know, this was long before Al-Anon had ever gotten started and whatever. Smitty juggled my memory. I'd like to bring this out. He said, you know, my mom doesn't get near the credit she ought to. We had a conversation with Bill Pittman and Ernie Kurtz and Mel and I a little while back there. And this topic, the first generation of the historians, that's who those guys were. They said, look, you know, we focused on Bill Wilson. That's where the lightning rod, the spotlight was. And we spent our lives doing this. We can't go everywhere. You know, we really overlooked the influence of the wives, and especially Ann. Bill always gave it. Bill Wilson always called her the mother of AA. When Bill was living there in Akron, when he and Bob were both trying to quit drinking there, she was the one that said, come on down in the living room here this morning, we're having quiet time. She's the one that kept an Oxford Group workbook and wrote down the principles that they were studying. She's the one that gave Bill Wilson what was later to be tagged spiritual pablum. She was the one that did the nuts and bolts while they were out there doing all of the fancy footwork. She was the one that was doing the cleaning and the beds and the this and everything. Henrietta Dotson, the wife of AA number 3, Bill Dotson, writes this. A very, just a beautiful, warm, charming person, Henrietta, writes this about Dr. Bob's wife. She says, on Friday, June the 28th, 1935, I met Ann Smith. I met Dr. Bob on Thursday morning in the hospital to see my husband. Dr. Bob was there, and he said, the little woman would like you to come over to the house. I told him I could not go that night, but would go the next night. On Friday, when I went to the house on Ardmore Avenue, I met the most thoughtful, understanding person I have ever known. After talking with her for a while, I addressed her as Mrs. Smith, and she said, Ann, to you, my dear. She wanted to remove all barriers. She wanted God to have full credit for this wonderful thing that had happened to her. Bill W. was there at this time. After they talked with me for a while, Ann asked me if I would like to go all the way with God. I told her I would. She said we should kneel, which we all did, and told me to surrender myself to God and ask him if he had a plan for me to reveal it to me. A quiet time in the mornings we always had that I might feel near to God and receive strength for the day. She taught me to surrender my husband to God and not try to tell him how to stay sober, as I had tried that and it failed. Ann taught me to love everyone. She said, ask yourself what is wrong with me today if I don't love you. She said the love of God is triangular. It must flow from God through me to you, and back to God. She told me I should never speak unkindly of the person leading the meeting, as we do not know God's plan, maybe that person's, what they say, will meet the need of someone else in the group. In the early part of 1936, Anne organized a woman's group for wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way she tried to teach us fraternal love and unselfishness. Anne made it very plain to me from the beginning that she wanted to know and to follow God's plan. When I met and talked with this intelligent, deeply spiritual woman, I was completely sold on Alcoholics Anonymous.
And I think she was that way all her life.
Al-Anon
was sprinkled his own on there.
You bet. Can you imagine Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and Ann Smith and Henrietta Dotson on their knees at 855 Ardmore surrendering to God? That's a powerful vision that just won't ever leave me.
Incidentally, when I was with Bill Dotson that Saturday that I was over in Akron, I asked him about the big book and why his story wasn't in there, and that's when I guess he told me that he hadn't been in favor of it or didn't think it was important or something like that. But he said that Bill Wilson had come out and taped his recollections and was going to write the story for him. And that's what was in the second edition, Anonymous Number 3. It was Bill Dotson's recollections, but it was Bill Wilson's writing that got the story in there. Now, Bill felt that Bill Dotson's story should be in there. And Bill Dotson was apparently also somewhat critical of the General Service Conference, kind of cool to the idea. But guess who the first delegate was from Akron? Bill Dotson.
Yeah, he was so... and a boy.
Yeah, Bill Dotson Jr.,
the third, second.
And
or was Bill Dotson, he was Bill, William I. Dotson, the attorney A, number three, was he was a junior, wasn't he? Bill Dotson II?
I'm not sure. But his son's name was the same name.
Bull Pinion.
That's how I got in touch with Henrietta later on. I looked the name up in the phone book.
Yeah.
And I assume he's still living in Akron and probably would be a man in his 60s now, young Bill. And
Bill Dotson didn't speak much, Darrell. I've only been able to run across two tape recordings. He wasn't a big one for going out there. He didn't, boy, this being AA number 3, he didn't want that tag at all. He just wanted to be one everybody else, you know.